Our collective nightmare, nearly 60 million people are told to layer up while the weather decides to punish travel for the rest of the week. Flights canceled, highways turned into ice rinks, a storm that likes the sound of the word bomb cyclone and is doing its best to live up to it. Airports are a theater of delays. Cars are sliding like they've forgotten how to drive. The country's main job today is getting somewhere without getting killed on the way. On top of the sky falling, the border bureaucracy is gearing up for a performance called Swamp Sweep. 250 agents will be sent to Louisiana. The Department of Homeland Security is pushing a travel ban, as if banning an entire set of countries is an actual policy and not a temper tantrum with paperwork. This came after shots in D.C. and an administration that answers violence with louder scapegoating. Promises to release a list of banned nations are coming soon, which is government speak for we will announce something when it suits the narrative. Meanwhile, the White House held a meeting about Venezuela. The administration is defending a decision to strike a boat twice, even though the military knew survivors were still alive after the first hit. The word war crime is now part of the discussion. Officials will testify to Congress if they absolutely must. The file with the moral argument is somewhere between classified and lost. Across oceans, rain is still a weapon. Floods and landslides in Southeast Asia have killed over 1,200 people. Rescue crews are pulling survivors out of a landscape that used to be dry land and now is not. Oxygen tanks and food are being airlifted, while the world scrolls past with short attention spans and longer takes on trivial celebrity feuds. Back home, the government decided not to mark World AIDS Day this year. A ritual observed since 1988 was shelved in the name of modernizing. We stopped remembering one of the things that kept us from repeating past mistakes. Simultaneously, a senior FDA official claimed COVID vaccines caused 10 child deaths and announced a tightening of vaccine approval rules without presenting the receipts. Trust is treated like a negotiable line item. A Trump envoy is flying to meet Putin to talk about ending a war. That is listed as a development. It is also a sentence that will exist in the same paragraph as a travel advisory and a possible war crime investigation. Because news now is a microwave method for collapsing weeks into a headline, gas dipping below $3 offers the kind of relief that looks good in a gas station window but does not fix structural collapse. Costco sues the government. A music mogul fights a docuseries. The son of a drug lord pleads guilty. Norway builds an undersea tunnel like an architect trying to one-up reality. North Korea gets a PR makeover, and someone calls it Pyonghattin. None of this is consoling. All of it is entertainment while the boat lists. The White House slogan of holiday lights apparently includes decorations adrift and things that make people sick without explanation. The imagery matches the mood, glittering chaos floating away from any sense of center, and the press conference has been replaced by the shrug. We log the deaths, the bans, the drownings, the flight boards, the lawsuits, the undersea feats, the diplomatic chess moves. We call it news because we must. We call it a report because that's the job. The circus has tightened security and booked more flights. The tent is soaking, the ringmaster is tired. We continue to tell you what fell apart today, so you can plan your drive or your votes or your grief.
Netflix is about to drop a docuseries about Sean Diddy Combs, produced by his longtime nemesis Curtis 50 Cent Jackson, and Combs' lawyers responded the way only billionaires do, with a cease and desist, a moral outrage, and a request for courtesy screeners that were apparently lost in the mail to Fort Dix. The line that makes this deliciously petty is this. Combs' team says Netflix used stolen footage that was actually commissioned by Combs himself because he's been making his own documentary since he was 19. Translation. He filmed himself obsessively for decades and now wants exclusive rights to his own narcissism. It's like watching someone build a birdhouse and then sue the bird for sitting in it. Then there's the setup. 50 Cent, the guy who used to diss him on mixtapes, now produces the film. The feud has aged into a corporate merger, and Combs is offended that his life's raw footage is being curated by a man who used to rhyme about him. If the 1990s taught us anything, it's that vendettas eventually monetize. Netflix says they obtained the footage legally. Combs claims they didn't. Neither side will let you see the full movie until the lawyers finish arguing over the receipts. Meanwhile, Combs is serving a federal sentence, appealing, facing dozens of civil suits, and reportedly asked the Trump administration about a pardon. But the hottest burning question in America today, who gets to premiere the director's cut of your own self-filmed life? The real first world problem here isn't the legal claim or the celebrity feud. It's the idea that in 2025, with the planet on fire and your phone recording everything, your biggest grievance can be that someone else packaged your self-obsession into a narrative you don't control and didn't even bother to send you a screener.
A safely read Tennessee district suddenly looks like the kind of place people write think pieces about when they want to feel dramatic. Democrats rolled a simple, sleepy idea, affordability, and watched it wobble the map. The spectacle is that a message about paying the bills now counts as insurgency. The matchup is between a Trump-backed ex-Army pilot and a Democratic state lawmaker who once said provocative things and now says she's changed. National leaders treat the race like a national exam. The president phoned into a rally. The House Speaker flew in. Former politicians and progressive celebrities joined virtual events. And outside groups poured millions into ads. The more things scream, "This is local," the more they are nationalized and monetized. Both sides claim to be fighting for the same thing, lower costs. That is the point that matters and the point that doesn't. It matters because grocery and healthcare prices actually hurt people. It doesn't because the whole exercise is run through a theater of accusation. Old podcast lines framed as proof of moral danger, accusations of wanting to defund police used like blunt instruments, the same ad shop swapping the word radical back and forth until it loses all meaning. Meanwhile, the House majority hangs by a thread, and every seat truly does matter, which is how you get a single district turned into a referendum on everything. Millions in outside spending reach a few thousand voters. A local race becomes a dress rehearsal for the midterms, with national actors trying on roles and testing lines. The money moves faster than policy. The rhetoric grows louder than the solutions. This feels less like politics than a management exercise for decline. Shout about affordability. Spend cash to prove you care. Point at the other side as proof of collapse, then repeat. If the stunt works, it's hailed as a mandate. If it fails, warnings of catastrophe follow. Either way, people still pay for gas and groceries, and the system that lets a single, nationally watched special election decide so much stays intact. The show goes on, with the same players, the same script, and the same inevitable sound of bills being passed to someone else.
From the article you provided titled "Musician Nick Cave Talks to Anderson Cooper About How the Loss of Two Sons Widened His Capacity for Love," comes a small and very human contradiction. Grief makes us bigger in ways we never wanted to grow. Think about that for a second. You lose what grounds you, your children, your routines, your illusions, and what's left is more room. More room for memory, for absence, for kindness, for sudden, unreasonable tenderness toward strangers. It's as if the universe, in taking something away, also hands you a new set of tools for feeling, useful, inconvenient, and slightly absurd. Nick Cave's interview is a polite reminder that suffering and expansion are not mutually exclusive. We expect trauma to shrink us, to harden us into neat, defensive shapes. Instead, sometimes it unravels those defenses and teaches us to carry more sorrow. Yes, but more love too. It's like discovering a basement you didn't know your house had, except the basement is full of feelings and nobody told you where the light switch is. There's also irony in the optics. Public figures talk about private collapses on televised stages. We watch with our polite faces and our popcorn, nodding as if grief were something you can parse, and then return to your email. That gap between spectacle and interior life highlights the absurdity of trying to process meaning in a world that constantly demands content. The deeper the wound, the more eloquent the answer seems to cameras and think pieces, which is to say, grief is both profoundly private and oddly marketable. And if grief expands capacity for love, what does that say about the rest of us? Perhaps love isn't a fixed reservoir. Maybe it behaves more like a sponge that, when squeezed by loss, reveals new pockets and stretches in unexpected directions. This idea is comforting and cruel at the same time. It comforts because it implies growth. It's cruel because growth came at a price no one would choose. There's a final, darkly comic truth here. Human life will always surprise us with paradoxes. We invent meaning, then watch it dissolve, then cobble together new meanings from the debris. We perform our pain in interviews and we fill the quiet afterward with ordinary acts, coffee, groceries, a text to someone we love. The absurdity is not that love can grow after loss. The absurdity is that we keep being surprised by our own resilience, as if survival were supposed to be neat and explainable. Maybe that is the point. We are messy appliances of love and loss, plugged into a socket that occasionally sparks. We make eloquent statements to television anchors. We file bug reports when an ad won't load. We sit with the impossible and somehow live through it. That is both tragic and ridiculous, and oddly enough, enough.
The capitalist fever dream, a $275 billion warehouse chain suing the federal government, isn't a rare spectacle anymore. It's the normal choreography of an economy that learned to prefer litigation to labor, paperwork to planning. Costco has marched into court not to punish a bad actor, but to secure the paperwork that guarantees it can recoup money it might be forced by presidential fiat to hand over. The spectacle is simple. The president invokes a 1977 emergency law. Customs starts collecting extra cash at the docks, and corporations sprint to the courthouse to preserve their balance sheets. The emergency powers that let a president slap sweeping tariffs on imports were written for wartime distortions, not bargaining chips for a political agenda. Yet the tool has become a revenue apparatus, a way to reorient trade policy overnight without the messy business of debate. Businesses aren't protesting the concept so much as the accounting. Will the money be refundable? Will customs let the math be finished? The answer determines whether corporate lawyers or actual supply managers win the day. Customs and Border Protection refusing more time to finalize tariff calculations is a bureaucratic punchline with real stakes. If deadlines are enforced, refunds risk being forfeited by default. Large retailers, tire makers, eyeglass framers, canned fish brands, and cosmetics companies all line up, not because consumers demanded it, but because their ledgers demand it. Litigation becomes a necessary stop on the conveyor belt between cheap imports and profit margins. Watch the coping mechanisms. Costco narrows suppliers, leans on local sourcing, and shelves more Kirkland-labeled goods. That's not resilience so much as triage. Move where tariffs don't reach. Obscure margins inside a private label turn customers into a buffer for trade policy shocks. The consumer pays, the brand survives, the market consolidates, and a handful of companies grow less exposed and more powerful. The Supreme Court's accelerated review turns what should be legislative reckoning into a judicial one. Justices appearing skeptical about the emergency law gambit is theater. The real theater ran long before, when policy was outsourced to decrees so companies could plan legal defenses instead of long-term strategies. The law becomes ambiguous on purpose because ambiguity preserves options, options that often translate into profit. This is capitalism playing emergency room. Triage is how the rich stay rich. Corporations spend on lawyers, reroute supply chains, and rebrand their way out of policy shock, while average shoppers absorb price spikes and smaller suppliers vanish. The system rewards those who can afford to wait in court. It punishes everyone else. Costco suing to protect its future refunds is not about justice. It is about preserving predictability for an industry that survives on razor-thin margins and predictable flows of goods. It is about keeping the machinery of consumption lubricated so shareholder returns do not wobble when the political winds shift. And when the machinery squeals, the response is always the same. Litigate, rebrand, consolidate. This isn't an isolated skirmish over tariffs. It's a symptom. Governance by emergency, markets governed by lawyers, consumers turned into shock absorbers. The daily craziness of corporate America, suing the government to guarantee repayment of overcharged tariffs, reshuffling suppliers to dodge political storms, reads less like capitalism at work and more like a feverish attempt to keep profit alive while the institutions that used to regulate it stagger under the weight.